From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Think Sex and the City, think Seinfeld, think Friends. A group of 20 and 30-something city dwellers, out of school, unmarried, no kids, doing everything or nothing with the same group of people, week after week, year after year. It's not just happening on TV. Our guest tonight, Ethan Waters, calls it tribalism of a new sort, a vital social and support network for young adults outside of family and marriage. Tonight on Point, the rise of the urban tribe and a redefinition of commitment and community when there's no rush to marry. But first, uproar today in Washington over who leaked the name of CIA agent Valerie Plame, wife of former ambassador and current Bush administration critic Joseph Wilson. Today, the White House and its staffers are combing through telephone logs and records in search of information relevant to a Justice Department investigation. Maura Reynolds is White House reporter for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her to assess the scale of the scandal and where it's headed.
Well, it potentially could be quite a big deal. It's sort of hard to tell at this point. I think the White House is operating at the moment on the idea that if they sort of play it calm and low for a few days, that it might just go away. And that's possible. But on the other hand, it has a lot of strains that are connected to a lot of other questions about the Bush presidency, about Iraq, the lack of weapons of mass destruction, about this administration's propensity for secrecy and discipline in the White House ranks, and all of those things get tied up in this particular incident, and depending on how it develops, it could be very damaging.
Now, there are political angles to this, obviously, and big ones, but at the heart of it, there's this explosive seriousness of this charge as a crime. Exposing the identity of a CIA operative is a felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison. If someone in the White House did this, the consequences could be huge.
Yes, and that's one thing that really sets this apart from other mini-scandals that have taken place so far, is that there actually is a criminal charge at the center of this one that is a felony, and that makes it much more legally damaging to the administration than anything that's come before.
More, remind us of the origins. Former Ambassador Joe Wilson went off to Africa to look into charges that nuclear materials had come out of there, perhaps to Iraq. He came back debunking indications from the Bush administration, and then?
Well, and then he thought that he'd reported that he didn't think there was any credibility to this incident. This was in the spring of 2002, so it was quite a while ago. And then the Bush administration, starting a year ago, September, began to push towards use of force against Iraq. And these uranium allegations related to the country of Niger in Africa started surfacing again. And he bit his tongue. I mean, he didn't say anything, including when the president mentioned them in his State of the Union address in January. He basically said nothing until after the war, until this July, when we'd been in Iraq for a couple of months and people were beginning to scratch their heads and say, I thought there were going to be weapons of mass destruction here and there aren't any. What happened? And that's when Wilson came forward and in an op-ed piece in the New York Times wrote, I think this administration twisted some of the facts going into Iraq. This is one allegation that I looked into. I didn't find that there was any validity to it, and yet the president and the administration has repeated it.
And the next thing you know, it's in the press that Ambassador Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, had been an undercover CIA agent. It is a felony to reveal CIA agent's identity, but there it is. How did that happen?
It's a little unclear exactly how it happened. It appeared in a column by Robert Novak, who's a very well-known Washington-based journalist who prides himself in being able to uncover little things about this very difficult town that we all work in. He reported it, crediting it to two administration officials. They kind of discredited Wilson by suggesting that it was only because his wife was in the CIA that he got this assignment from the CIA to check out the Niger allegations.
So it sounded like it was intended as a dig, but it also had the consequence of ending her career and exposing her. And exactly how did Robert Novak source this? Who did he say he got it from?
Well, from senior administration officials, but as you're well aware, we often use that phrase in this town, and that can cover a variety of different contexts and a variety of different people. Novak himself seems to have changed his story about whether this came up in the course of an interview with a senior administration official or whether, in fact, the senior administration official called him to tell him about this.
But the word on the street in Washington is this was being aggressively pushed by the White House. They wanted someone to publish this.
It's not really clear. The Washington Post had a story over the weekend that they may or may not be backing down from at this point, saying that at least two administration officials called at least six different Washington reporters to discuss Wilson and Plame. And that may or may not be the case. But at the moment, anyway, it seems as though the most damaging thing to the White House could be if there was a concerted effort by officials in the White House to call reporters and try to discredit Wilson by deliberately suggesting that he was unqualified for the assignment because his wife worked in the CIA.
President Bush says he wants to know the truth. If someone in his White House violated the law, he said the person will be taken care of. The Democrats love this because, as you write, it's a juicy political opportunity. They've got they get to accuse the Bush administration of playing fast and loose with national security, and someone may be dangling in the wind here.
Well, yeah, and presumably that someone is in the White House. And this is another thing that shows just how potentially damaging this is to this White House. They haven't had a scandal like this before where you've got a criminal investigation going on that will try to find an individual inside this administration.
John Ashcroft says he'll do it. He doesn't need a special counsel. His Justice Department will do it. Is he seen as nonpartisan enough to credibly execute that investigation?
Well, the Democrats obviously think that he isn't. But you have to remember that the special counsel rules under which they would likely operate, if they moved to that, they would have been written by Janet Reno. They would have been written under a Democratic administration. So what the Bush administration, both the Department of Justice and the White House, is saying right now is that they are following established procedures, that they're going to be investigated by a special division of the FBI that is nonpartisan, that are professional prosecutors who deal with counter-espionage cases exclusively, and that those people are completely nonpartisan and well able to do the job. If the case takes on a more political tenor, they can always move to a special counsel, which even though it would still be under the aegis of the Department of Justice, at least by the previous Democratic administration, this was considered to be adequate to ensure a fair investigation.
And the Democrats, who suffered endlessly through Bill Clinton's travails over what is and whether or not there was a lie about an intern, must be just thrilled to see charges of counter-espionage or related to that in the air.
Yeah, I mean, and the Republicans on Capitol Hill are sort of saying, wait, you know, a few years ago you weren't so keen to have special counsel investigations all the time. Turnabout is fair play in politics. But this is, in some ways, more serious because if the charges hold up, you are talking about a felony. And it's not just whether someone cheated on his wife. It's a breach of national security, potentially.
Maura Reynolds, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Maura Reynolds is White House reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with us from Washington. Two years ago, in a piece written for the New York Times magazine, Ethan Waters touched off a chorus of Me Toos from 20 and 30-somethings across the country. Gen Xers had a unique form of community, he wrote, cultivated in the expanding middle years between leaving school and entering marriage. They formed tight-knit groups, or as he called them, urban tribes. Now, in a new book, an older and married Ethan Waters shares the stories of his tribal years and those of thousands of like-minded never-marrieds from Seattle to Detroit to New York, how young and not-so-very-young Americans find solace in their fellow tribe members through breakups, addictions, and layoffs, how a circle of friends often now substitutes for spouse and family. Does this picture ring true to you? Have you found your urban tribe? And what place has it filled in your life in times of need, in times of joy? Are Americans onto a new support system here that lets marriage wait? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Ethan Waters, author of Urban Tribes, A Generation Redefines Friendship, Family, and Commitment. Good evening and welcome, Ethan Waters.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for joining us tonight, Ethan. And with me in the studio tonight, Jack Beatty, our own news analyst here at On Point and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Ethan Waters, you've poured your heart into a book explaining what all those Gen X slackers are doing between college and marriage, and I was struck at the extent to which it sounds like an apologia. Does your generation have something to apologize for in waiting to marry?
Well, I think that was part of the motivation for writing the book, was to look at this time period. I think the first thing that often happens when people look at their lives and say they're 30 or 35 and they're not married, they get very anxious about it. And that anxiety often comes in the form of wondering whether your life is off track, whether you're wasting your time, whether you are doing your part for the community around you. And I think the first thing that we often do in that situation is beat ourselves up a little bit. And that's where the narrator starts in the book, the narrator who is me starts, is wondering those exact questions. Are we wasting our time? Is this delay? What does the delay mean? And does it mean we're just being selfish with our lives?
You write that we worried that our lives were not as meaningful as those lived in families. We worried also that we were more selfish and less community-minded than our parents. Perhaps most pervasively, we worried that there was something wrong with us that kept us from finding love. So you went out to find what was actually going on. And what is it that you found, this social structure, this urban tribe?
Well, I began looking at my own life and wondering, everyone agreed during that time, I think, from, Hillary Clinton, it takes a village, to, George Bush and his encouragement to join the Thousand Points of Light, that something had gone dramatically wrong. So there was a general agreement out there that we were slipping away from that community building. And basically, I looked at that literature and Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, and I began to wonder why I didn't. Why I both agreed with the statistics that he sort of had in the book, but disagreed with the feeling that I had about living in San Francisco. I felt there was something about my life in San Francisco that made me feel remarkably connected to the city, remarkably connected to a social group.
Even though it wasn't through traditional institutions and bowling leagues.
It wasn't through the bowling leagues, it wasn't through the Lions clubs or the League of Women Voters, and it wasn't through family, most importantly, or neighbors. And I began to sort of wonder why I was wasn't feeling as depressed as the statistics might indicate that I should.
So what was the new integrating factor that you saw there?
So basically, it was one of those moments where I saw this thing in my life that had been so close to me, it had been hard for me to see. It was this remarkable group of friends that had been with me for over 10 years at that point. And literally, this what I call this urban tribe in my life formed around me so naturally that it was that it really almost for a while escaped me giving specific attention to it. But once I identified it and began to write about it and wrote that little piece in the New York Times Magazine and had this remarkable response from people around the country saying, I see it in my life too now.
We're not slackers. We're doing something different here. That was the response you got.
I think that is, exactly. We're not, we are people that are providing support for the people around us. We are community-minded in this private way, if that's not a contradiction in terms. People were looking into their lives and finding a lot of joy and connection in them. And they began to sort of help me tell the story of what this the potential of these years, the potential that's held within these years.
We're going to look more at that. Stand by, Ethan Waters. Jack Beatty, maybe Ethan just put his finger on it. He said community-minded in a private way. I mean, he was looking for meaning in those long years now available to young Americans between school, between college and marriage, and saying, whoa, that wasn't nothing, that was something. That was, in his word, a tribe.
It certainly was. I mean, Marx called the family a haven in a heartless world. And between our family of origin and our family of choice, there is this long period of some would call it the moratorium, where things are delayed. And if we didn't have groups then, if we didn't have havens then, we would be exposed to the heartless world in a damaging way. So if these tribes didn't exist, they'd have to be invented for the sake of man's sanity.
And it is a longer span now than it used
Very
to be.
Much
People
so.
Are not rushing to marriage straight out of school. Ethan Waters, stand by. We're talking tonight about the long unmarried lives of young Americans and the tribes that pull them through, the friends of the real world, if you will, with Ethan Waters, author of the new book, Urban Tribes. You can join the conversation. Do your friends function as a kind of family, a kind of tribe? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the long, unmarried lives of young Americans and the tribes that pull them through the time between school and marriage. It's gotten much longer in recent years. Ethan Waters is with us, joins us from San Francisco. He's a journalist and author of the new book, Urban Tribes, A Generation Redefines Friendship, Family, and Commitment. Ethan, I wonder if you'd read a bit for us to give a flavor of the kind of conversations that you were party to as you and your no-blood relation, no-marital relation, tribe of friends lived through those years in San Francisco. There's a bit on page 16 that you might dive into for us. We'd love to hear it.
I'd be happy to. Let me set this up just a second. We're on our way. We're all driving in a car on the way to one of the rituals that my tribe has. There's a yearly trip to Burning Man, this art festival that's held out in the desert. And I just recently asked them in the car, I basically said, whatever happened to getting married? And I was waiting for the response, and so here we go. There was a growing sense among us that our post-college pre-family life was stretching into an awfully long time, 5, 10, almost 15 years for some, and that maybe we had missed a turn somewhere. Our parents, having suffered through introductory dinners with half a dozen or a dozen prospective mates, were becoming concerned. They worried for us, or if they were less generous and more eager for grandchildren, accused us of being slackers, a word they had come to understand from listening to public radio. Jen, a fast-thinking criminal defense lawyer who was often first out of the block with her notions, answered first. Women have their own career and resources. They no longer need the institution of marriage to survive, she said. Jen had grown up in middle-income New Jersey, but had managed to shake most of the trappings of that life in her hipper, less-permed California incarnation. It's simple economics. Most women still want to get married, but fewer women feel like they have to. Besides, we have those little things to open jars for us now. It's the breakdown of tradition in the city, said Adam, a documentary filmmaker and true child of left-wing Berkeley. Our families can't force us to do anything anymore, and the church has even less power. We put ourselves first now. We can't get married because we are tragically selfish. It's simpler than that. We're not getting married because it's no longer required before having sex, offered Josh, a tall, handsome underachiever who was always pragmatic when it came to sexual issues and opportunities. You know, if the milk is free, who's going to sell the cow? You mean buy the cow? No one wants to buy the cow, said Jen, hitting Josh on the back of the head. It's a wonder you get any milk at all. I think our generation grew up with too much marital carnage, Alicia offered tentatively. A graduate student in her late 30s, she was new to our group and was still getting used to the hang of how we talked about the world. We spent our adolescence ducking and covering as families up and down the block went off like bombs. We get post-traumatic stress symptoms just going home for Thanksgiving, like revisiting a combat zone. I paused as they waited for my theory.
Ethan Waters, reading from his new book, Urban Tribes, and your theory is what we're here to learn about, Ethan. So what is it? Tribe. Why do you say tribe? What's the relationship that you saw emerging there?
Well, this is as natural a thing as humans can do. This is, I think, if you looked at any subculture that was given this situation that we have now, thrown into a city as individuals and given a long time outside of a family, what you would find is people forming these groups forming similar forms of groups outside of family, very tight-knit groups of friends.
And what's the structure? What's the interaction? Is this just like, our gang, groups of friends that people have always had, or is there something that sets this apart, either in the flavor of the membership, the character, the way people interact?
Sure. There are a couple of things that set it apart. But specifically what happens, I mean, these do begin as groups of friends. What happens is when you multiply that interaction by 5 years and then, 8 years and then 10 years, what happens is the groups, a number of things happen. One is the groups have become more formalized. The individual roles that people take on within the group become sort of harder. And
the way they might in a family or even in a marriage.
Right. And the traditions the group have become sort of more ritualized. Groups tend to do the same thing, same yearly rituals. Often they have monthly or even weekly rituals. And the group begins, because of those rituals, begins to have a lore that it tells itself over time that new members as they come in are written into the story of the tribe. So it becomes more than the simply addition of the friendships. The group actually has a group history that can last longer than the, you know, an individual. You know, it's not critical to have one individual member.
And you're making the case here that there's really something emerging that's kind of new in its depth, in its duration, in the intensity and depth of relationship, in the sense of mutual obligation and support, that you're really kind of defining a new, I don't know, a new life chapter here that's available because Americans are waiting so long to get married?
This generation has delayed marriage longer than any generation in American history, and that the energy for these groups comes directly out of that delay, out of that time that we spend outside of families.
Your friends that you quoted here in the reading raise a lot of issues. They say, why are we doing this? And they say, first, it's the breakdown of tradition in the city. And I wondered about that. You call it urban tribes. Why urban? Why city? Is this a purely urban phenomenon?
It is not. It's not a purely urban phenomenon. It can, you know, I have seen it happen in destination resort towns, say, where college people end up after college working in sport industries or gambling industries. It's primarily urban because the marriage delay exists longer in urban centers than it does in the smaller towns. So the energy for the urban tribe is from the time we have to spend outside of families. And that's longer in urban centers, and therefore it's more predominant in urban centers.
But if the telephone lines tell me anything, it tells me that it may not only be cities. Let's turn there. Tyler's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Tyler. You're on the air.
Hi. I've got two comments that are almost a dichotomy of each other.
Okay.
First of all, I identify with your guest, and this is actually the first time I've heard this brought up in such a light. I grew up in far western suburban Chicago, and have a group of friends with me. I'm 27 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a group of friends, you know, 5 to 10, you know, ebbs and flows, that have been with me since elementary school. And it's not a stagnant relationship, and that's kind of why I think other friends and family don't really understand our group dynamic.
Tyler, are you married? Are any of you married?
No, actually, none of us are.
And when your family looks at this group of friends, do they say, Tyler, what are you doing? Get off your duff and get a wife.
No, they don't. Personally, I'm gay, and all my other friends, most of them are males, and they're all heterosexual.
Okay.
A few female friends, too. And we all just congealed such as a group, and I was closer with some through some periods of time, and then it changed over the years. You know, sometimes I was closer with some with others, but as a whole, we're all a very tight-knit group, and friends and family don't understand, you know, like, why, like, when your guest was saying Christmas and Thanksgiving and stuff comes around, why it's like, yes, I want to spend time with my, you know, my nuclear family, my immediate family, sister, you know, mother, father, that.
Why aren't you at the family table? Tyler, let me ask you this. Does this put some kind of more permanent, long-term relationship off the table for you? Are you saying, is this a lifetime commitment or is it an interlude?
No, I think it's a lifetime thing. And I'm really curious to read your guest book because we've actually, several of us, well, I'm not personally, but some of my friends are writers, you know, not professionally, and we've joked about, you know, how our lives, as we've come to meet other people who just don't have, you know, there's some people out there who are lucky to have one close friend.
Let alone 5 or let alone 10. Tyler, we've got it, and thanks very much for your call. Jack Beatty, there's a whole spectrum laid out here. I mean, we should say our guest tonight and author ends the book married. And looking forward to, actively looking forward to a new chapter that's more nuclear in his life. We'll talk about that and what that suggests. But our caller Tyler says, wow, you know, maybe life doesn't require a one-on-one pairing.
Maybe indeed. And, you know, you raised a question, and he mentioned it too, of the city and why the city was so important. Well, I was wondering what Mr. Waters' book rang a bell with me, and it reminded me of one of the foundation papers in modern sociology by Georg Simmel, the German sociologist. It's called The Metropolis and Mental Life. Mm. Let me just read a sentence or two. The first sentence, the deepest problems of modern life derive from the claim of the individual to preserve the autonomy and individuality of his existence in the face of overwhelming social forces, of historical heritage, of external culture, and of the technique of life. He says that in the city, rationality rules. It reduces all quality and individuality to the question, how much? All intimate emotional relations between persons are founded in their individuality, whereas in rational relations, man is reckoned with like a number, like an element which is in itself indifferent. Then he says, these features of intellectuality contrast with the nature of the small circle in which the individual knowledge, and in which the inevitable knowledge of individuality as inevitably produces a warmer tone of behavior, a behavior which is beyond a mere objective balancing of service and return. That is to say, the metropolis uniquely concentrates these forces in modern life that depersonalize us and that drive our spirituality into and our individuality into pulverize it. And therefore, the small circle is a place where people can recreate their individuality, where they can be recognized for their idiosyncrasies. The division of labor forces it out of them, the necessity to adopt what Simmel calls reserve in the city, emotional reserve, all that can go away and you can be healed. That is to say, your mental life can receive a kind of soothing in the small circle. So it's almost a functionally, it's a necessity in under the conditions of the metropolis as described by Simmel.
Ethan Waters, who knew Gaylord Simmel had your number and a couple of years back here, maybe?
Absolutely. Well, I think the thing he identified, and I certainly don't want to lay claim to discovering something totally new under the sun. My case in the book is that this is an expression of our human nature. I mean, these groups, this group formed in my life and these groups formed in other people's lives, almost as if they grew just utterly organically. No one taught us how to do this. No one told us to do this. This is the type of group that would come out of this situation that humans are put in a massive city that is, in many ways, impersonal and depersonalizing.
But is there something new here? I mean, the small circle in your case is not the church social, and it's not the guild. And it's not the, you know, as you said, it's not the Rotary Club. What is the glue? What's the magnet that determines who's in your urban tribes, Ethan Waters?
It is simply a clustering of friendships. Social scientists would say we have a highly clustered group. That is, one of my friend tends to know all my other friends. So there is this sort of growing gravity over time that these groups have that simply sort of keep people within the orbit. It is utterly by our choice that we are, you know, that we create this gravity. And there is no, you're right, there is no sort of formalized agreement between us. And there is actually no sort of moment where we would sort of recognize who is in the group and who is out there. The group is a little bit constantly in motion.
But despite that, it can be a foundation stone for the individuals in it, despite that flux, despite that informality, despite that, you know, ebb and flow of membership?
Despite all that, it can be. At any given moment, the sensation of being in the group, the feeling you get within the group is that it is a tight-knit circle. What I discovered after I wrote that article and started the book was that if I look at these groups over time, they actually are in flux. There is a member sort of coming in with that social gravity and a member sort of going out for some reason. And over time, you can find that these groups actually change membership over, especially if you have a group that goes over 10 years or so. But at any given moment, you feel as if you're in a tight-knit group that is emotionally supporting your life in the city.
Hey, a lot of marriages don't last 10 years. Dominique is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Dominique. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm on a car phone, so it may get a little weird.
Okay.
But my inclinations lie completely with your guests, perhaps because I spent 4 years in boarding school and high school growing up. But my template for living is the tribal template. And I'm divorced. I tried being married in my 20s. I'm a little older than a Gen Xer, but I found that marriage was no substitute for a group. And my life is very good. I mean, I feel like I have groups that overlap with each other in Cambridge, on the Vineyard, in Europe, in New York. So it's really extensive, and it feels to me very secure and very satisfying.
Dominique, you're breaking up, but we've got it. It sounds like quite a life. But Jack, it's not built around marriage. Dominique tried that. She says she prefers the group. There's something very, to your point with Gaylord Simmel and with Ethan Waters, something very contemporary, very modern about this. I'll pick and choose as I like. Don't bind me in any kind of contract here, but let a circle grow around me.
Yes, and, you know, she had tried marriage, she said, and it wasn't in many ways as satisfying or as holding, she almost seemed to be saying, as this group. And notice how the group was spread out. I mean, she had different locales, different countries. She was part of a large social circle that sustained her. And, of course, as against marriage and serious sexual and emotional relationships, the individual is less vulnerable. You know, you're not putting all your chips in one basket. You're not risking your whole life with the other. And that is a decision people delay because it is momentous. Even in a society that makes divorce common, the choice of whom to marry and when is a momentous choice because it forecloses some of the freedom that Dominique has been talking about.
And off it gets put here. Jay's calling from Buffalo. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm really interested to read this book. I don't think that what the author is describing is unusual at all. I think in, say, 50 years ago, there was one mode of normalcy, which was getting married, having kids, settling down, white picket fence. But now, in this day and age, there's a lot of things that are considered normal. And in my life in the last 2 years has been very interesting because I was married for about 6 years, and then I was single again at 31. And I found this whole universe of people my age who were either never married, as you described, or had a starter marriage when they were young. And the vast majority of these people are not in a rush to get married. And when you're a single person, you tend to have single friends. I have single friends. I went from...
Jay, do you have men? Do you have men and women in your post-marriage circle or tribe?
More, I'd say more women than men because, I have my own theories on that. But it's...
And are they equally disenchanted with marriage or equally open to just...
I think the women tend to be more eager to get married, but as you get older, they're less likely to settle. And, you know, if you don't fit into my life 99.5%, why should I settle for 92%? Because I've made my own life, and I'm speaking from the point of view of, say, a woman over 30. You know, they know, or anyone over 30 has a better idea of what they want, so why should they settle for less?
Jay, we've got the picture, and we thank you very much for calling it in from Buffalo. We've got to take a short break here. Ethan Waters, sit with that for a second. We'll come right back and talk about gender perspectives on tribal life as opposed to married life. We're talking about the long unmarried lives of young Americans and the tribes that pull them through. Our guest tonight is Ethan Waters. He joins us from San Francisco. He's a journalist and author of the new book, Urban Tribes, A Generation Redefines Friendship, Family, and Commitment. You can join the conversation. Are you getting all you need from friends? Do you ask who needs marriage? And are you young and single and feeling guilty for it, that you're slacking on your adult responsibilities? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the long unmarried lives of young Americans and the tribes that pull them through. Our guest is author Ethan Waters, joins us from San Francisco. He's author of the new book, Urban Tribes, A Generation Redefines Friendship, Family, and Commitment. We've had callers by the tribe load wanting to get on tonight, and let's keep them coming. Paul's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is that friendship, the issue here is that these urban tribe is being defined as a close knit of people who stick together through tough times or easy times and really are having a good time at it. And my point is that the fact of friendship actually isn't just limited to single urbanites, but it extends to all sorts of people. Married people also have many close friends. and units that they stick together with, and that's just because they share similar likes and dislikes. And
So does it sound to you, Paul, like nothing new here, just friendship?
Right, it's just pure friendship, and you know, it's not limited to urban single people. Married couples have friends as well.
We got it. Paul, thanks for your call. Ethan Waters, how about it? Paul says, hey, it's in the air, it's everywhere, it's friendship, it's an old story.
Paul is exactly right. The friendship is everywhere, and people find these groups throughout their lives. The distinct thing about the never married is that they have it as their primary sort of social support system. It is the primary us in their life, which is, you know, distinct from family, distinct from neighborhood, distinct from organizations of any sort, whether that be on your job or avocations. And that is, that makes it, to me, you know, not different in kind, but different in character and worth identifying and worth writing about.
So what's going on then? What's your explanation for why Americans are waiting so much longer for marriage?
Well, there's a number of possible reasons. The full integration of women into the workforce is one clear reason. Women are doing their advanced education and going into very demanding careers that take years to master.
So they don't have time to get married, or they don't have the economic need to get married?
Well, both. The education delays the time when you'd want to get married, and the entry into that career delays. But also the resulting career that gives you those financial resources as a woman makes marriage not an economic necessity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very clear. It's also very clear that we no longer need the institution of marriage to have sex. And that's
pretty powerful.
That is pretty powerful when you look back a few generations where there was a great deal of pressure to get married before having sex. One of my theories is that, and I think a couple of the callers have sort of touched on this, which is that after you've done this sort of tribal lifestyle, these groups of friends for 5 or 10 or more years, that lifestyle has its own momentum, and it actually becomes a little nerve-wracking to conceive of that other thing, of marriage, and make that leap into that individual or that sort of small couple relationship when you have this warm group of friends that you've cultivated over years, and then existing outside of that group is this idea of marriage and, tying your horse with one,
And yet we could feel that kind of longing for that among many members of the tribes you described, even in your own case, Ethan Waters. Right. You were celebrating marriage by the end of this book about tribes.
Absolutely. Well, one of the reasons I want to start a dialogue about this time of life is I want people to sort of begin to look at it more clearly, not simply let the tribe life sort of exist without examining it. And it does have an opportunity cost, particularly for women who, say, live their entire 30s among this group of an urban tribe. There's a different opportunity cost for them than there is for men. And they need to understand
because
that.
Because the childbearing years may go by while they're with the gang.
Exactly. It may be much more difficult to conceive a child or have as many children as you might have wanted. Once you get to the end of your 30s.
Which makes it's just a lark, but really, really consequential. I want to get to the phones.
Absolutely.
Elizabeth's calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You know, I just wanted to get back a minute to what you started with in the beginning, which was, you know, what about the problems that were cited in Bowling Alone? There are no more mm-hmm. organizations and friends, and Seinfeld is this sort of, these new urban tribes, is this a new thing? And I thought, you know, Jack was right on the mark to say, you know, well, Marx was saying that the family was this haven in a heartless world. But
yes.
I think that Marx would also say, my God, today alienation and individualism have completely run amok. And what we see now, in fact, according to the author of this book, and I think it really reflects a couple of things, so two things. One is the challenges and the transformations of the counterculture. And also feminism, which really rebelled against the dreadful realities of the nuclear family.
Elizabeth, let me ask you first, when you say counterculture, are you drawing a thread back here to teepees and communes, or is this something new?
You know, I think, well, I mean, you could almost say that during the 60s, you know, there was birth control, you know, it was that, you know, yes, you can possibly have sex with people and not absolutely have to marry them.
Mm.
There was a move away from the nuclear family. Of course, you know, you've got to recognize, and I'm sure your guest probably does, that a lot of this has its own racial and class dimensions here. I mean, these,
yes,
you know,
Ethan Waters is pretty clear about that.
I think there is a human need for commitment, for community, and people are going to develop it, you know, no matter what. And I think they're going to find it and create it, and they find sustenance and they find pleasure and they find, you know, all of our basic human needs there. Now, maybe it's not in the extended family, but that's not to say that certain groups of people in our society still find that. Of course, in extended families. I think the danger here is, though, that it becomes a lifestyle that, you know, is still experimental. And over the long haul, what is that really going to mean in later years?
What's it adding up to?
People really need community and families. He's right. Family structures have broken down. They've been attacked, and they have fragmented and fractured. But on the long haul, you know, are they really going to be able to sustain people and nurture the next generation? For example, are these people going to be against taxes for public schools?
Yeah, it's a good question. Wow, Elizabeth, you're really on. Thanks for calling. Let us try and pick that up. Ethan, let's jump first in on class. I mean, you write throughout or are describing this as between college and marriage. That's a pretty big class sword you're pulling through right there.
It is, and I have to apologize for that.
Why apologize? Is that the fact you're describing?
Well, primarily it's motivated by the fact that a third of this book is memoir. It's me trying to figure out what the last 20 years of my life meant, which were the 20 years in between, or 15 years between college and getting married.
But is this a class phenom or not?
It is in one sense, which is that you do find the marriage delay in cities among highly educated people sort of you do find a demographic that has that aspect of it more than other groups. So, but the fundamental idea that you would bind together with friends and have support each other is obviously not a class phenomenon. You'd find this in other demographics where you had a marriage delay or a time outside of family or a set of people outside. This is a human nature thing. So there is an extent to which it's not class.
And Elizabeth raised so much, we can't get to it all, but what about the long haul question? Does this really work? Does this create a society where one generation takes into account the next? These people, as you point out, may not ultimately have children.
Elizabeth was really on. That was a fantastic comment and question. I actually think that most people will actually get married who live in this marriage delay. That's what the social scientists tend to think. Their marriages are looking very strong. The longer the marriage is delayed, the more likely it is to be a marriage that sort of lasts the distance, according to the people that are tracking these trends. This generation is not cynical about marriage. It is not cynical about children or family. It simply had this other experience. And I don't think that's necessarily led to a decision about the rest of their lives.
But is it going to vote for new schools during that long tribal period? Is it going to pick up a Social Security burden if it's laid down?
I believe there's so much energy within these groups to transform it into a transform that energy into a broader community energy. I think that our generation is just flexing its muscles. There are, you know, the critical mass bicycle demonstrations. There's the Burning Man. There's all these ways. There's the flash mobs. There's all these ways in which suddenly these groups, which are at the core of all these activities, are beginning to have a sort of expression at a larger social level. And I think our generation is going to figure out how to use the energy within these groups and how they connect to other groups.
And then our time is so short, Ethan Waters. We've got it, but I'm struck then at the end of all this tribal activity, you meet a young psychiatrist dressed up at a tribal party, dressed up as Betty Rubble, of all things, and you're off on the marriage bandwagon. What happens to the tribe? Have you abandoned that?
No, I have not, but there's definitely I identified right away that there was a transition here and that this was one risk that you took in your young single years that you couldn't really turn to your friends and say, hey, you know, support me in this risk, because that risk was a little bit of a danger for them. That was the idea of losing me a little bit to this other relationship. So there was a time period where I had to make an important take a jump without that support of my friends, and that was a jump into that relationship. And now, 1 year into the marriage, and we're just about to have a daughter, and the tribe is there absolutely every day in my life, and I intend to find a way to use that energy throughout the rest of my life to support me and to support my wife and my child.
Ethan Waters, it's a candid and fascinating book. We thank you for sharing the ideas there with us. Thanks for joining us tonight.
It's been a real pleasure being on. Thank you.
Ethan Waters in San Francisco. He's author of the new book, Urban Tribes, A Generation Redefines Friendship, Family, and Commitment. There it goes, Jack. I mean, they've always been friends, but I suppose if you're unmarried 12 years instead of two, there is more time to cultivate that.
There is, and you know, we had the caller, Elizabeth, who raised so many, interesting ideas, but one of them was that there could be something selfish about this way of life. But you know, the family, too, can be an ethical dead end. I only care about mine and my kid and my life, and you know, and for one thing, when you have children, you are isolated from so much so many other things you could be doing. So it's hard to know how to cut that one there, but a lot to think about. A
lot of ways to go. Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can continue online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, Amtrak CEO stands up against deregulation of the passenger rail industry. This is On Point. The management of Amtrak has asked a federal judge to bar its workers from striking Friday. Six unions representing 8,000 workers are threatening a one-day work stoppage to protest against what they say is inadequate funding for the National Passenger Railroad. Yesterday, the embattled rail services president and CEO, David Gunn, addressed those who have called for sweeping reforms of Amtrak. Gunn said that while Amtrak needs to be more efficient, those who have called for deregulation of the passenger rail industry are way off the mark. Here are excerpts of his speech delivered at the National Press Club in Washington.
All of these reformers end up with some form of privatization. Now, in order to privatize, you have to have a profitable business. That's economics 101. We are not profitable, and we aren't going to be profitable, and there is no profitable core. You're always going to need a subsidy for inner-city rail, just as you do for transit and most airlines. Secondly, if you're going to make privatization your goal, you have to have, that means you're going to have competitions, companies forming and so forth. You have to have technically skilled human capital available to you to run these places. This industry, the railroad industry, has been in decline for decades. It has gone from when I went to work, over a million people working for the railroads, to about 200,000 today. Of the 200,000, 20,000 work for us. There is no vast pool of talent outside the existing companies. The supply industry. You need a supply industry. The supply industry for passenger rail in particular has nearly collapsed. We couldn't even buy couplers this summer in the United States. Lastly, you need proven operators, and there aren't many of those around. Some would say we're not, but we are. So my view is that pretending that you're going to run this thing without subsidy, irregardless of whether it's Amtrak or some other functionary or organization, is really an exercise in problem avoidance. And the issue is, it's probably bigger than Amtrak. The essential story here is the same. Whether we're talking about creating a reliable national power grid, providing universal broadband internet service, modernizing roads and transit systems, or ensuring adequate supplies of water and natural gas. Rather than face up to the true costs of keeping up these vital public services, it's become routine for politicians to neglect them and underinvest, often under the banner of misguided deregulation and mindless tax and rate cutting. Only now are we discovering that there is a real cost to this neglect. In other words, what I'm saying here is that if you really want passenger service, inner-city rail service, you're going to have a subsidy.
Amtrak's President David Gunn speaking at the National Press Club in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.